He's Disney John.
And he's Dayton.
And we're from the Docking Bay 77 podcast.
Friendly nerds discussing what they're listening to, watching, and reading.
But we're not here to talk about us.
Oh, heck no. We're here to talk about our friends, Jason and Dee.
Today, the guys are diving into two of the most gloriously oddball comedies the 1980s ever gave us.
Tim Burton's Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Weird Al's UHF. One's about a man and his beloved bicycle.
And the other is about a man and his beloved UHF station. Which is basically the same thing, right?
Well, except one gave us Marsh Mars, and the other gave us Gandhi with a machine gun.
One taught us how not to chain up your bike.
And the other taught us that, yes, you really can open a store that sells only spatulas.
So put on your red bow tie.
Or grab a Twinkie Wiener sandwich, because Pee-wee and Weird Al are about to get weird.
Wait, surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Okay, boys and girls, today's secret word is weird. All right, we are here to talk about a couple of weird movies. We have got two incredible icons of the 80s who are famous for being quirky and different and changing the way that we view things. We're here today to talk about Pee-wee Herman's Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes.
And we're here today to talk about Weird Al Yankovic's UHF.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to have to call him Al, or we're going to be screaming the whole show.
That's right, that's right.
We are comparing these two movies. Pee-wee's Big Adventure came out in 1985. UHF came out in 1989. Both of them are cult classics. One of them did well in the theater, and one of them did not. And we're going to kind of explain why in just a bit. But this is just going to be a fun little ride. I talked to Jason. He's been bugging me to do Pee-wee's Big Adventure for years now.
I have.
And I had never seen the movie all the way through. I'd seen bits and pieces of it. I remember seeing Pee-wee's Playhouse a bit when I was young. I remember seeing Pee-wee at the Big Top. Is that what it was called?
Big Top Pee-wee.
Big Top Pee-wee. That's it. I saw that one in the theater. Thought it was great. Apparently, I was one of the few people. Thought it was great.
Yeah,
Did not do well. But I got to finally watch it all the way through for the first time. You kind of dragged me kicking and screaming.
I did. I'm so anxious to hear what you think, man.
I'm excited to talk about it. I had a good time no spoiler, but yeah, I had a good time watching this movie, even though I had a lot of reservations about watching it. And we're talking about UHF, which I listened to our weird episode, which came out back in 2022, almost this time back then. And we had talked about that we had bumped UHF to cover that movie, the biopic starring Daniel Radcliffe. It was interesting, it's 3 years ago. And we have talked about doing UHF every single year since then. And then finally, it dawned on us as we were trying to figure out what to compare Pee-wee's Big Adventure to, UHF was the obvious choice.
Yeah, it was. So for the longest time, I've had kind of a special connection with UHF because it was filmed in my hometown. Mm-hmm. The Outsiders was filmed in my hometown, but I was a little kid. I was like 9, right? Yeah. So I couldn't have gone anywhere, But UHF, I remember on the local radio station, the guys saying, hey, they're shooting a scene at 61st in Peoria today. They need extras. It's Weird Al. Everybody come down. You want to be in a movie? Come on down. And next song on the countdown is Sweet Child of Mine. So that was summer of 1988.
Yeah.
So Weird Al was in town. I knew where he was staying. Like the place, the Kensington Mall allowed him to, it was a hotel connected to a mall, so he could stay and shoot kind of all in the same spot.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then just a few weeks ago, you and I took a day trip to Tulsa, made a video, went to all the UHF locations we could find, plus a few extras.
Yeah.
Go to our YouTube page, check that out. It's really cool.
It's very fun. We had a great time.
We had a great time doing that. And then little did we know, but Weird Al was
yes.
He was playing at the Brady Theater like a couple of days after we were there.
Which is across the street from Cooney's Karate School. So you gotta go check out that video to find that. I mean, it was serendipitous. We just happened to, we were like, oh, let's go shoot something at the Brady Theater. And there we saw Weird Al's name as the only name on the marquee. It was just
pretty spectacular.
Meant to be.
Cooney's Karate School and the Brady Theater share a parking lot.
Yeah. crazy.
So, all right. To get us started, I guess we got to kick this thing off with Pee-wee's Big Adventure because that's the first movie.
There's a lot of things about me you don't know anything about, Daddy. Things you wouldn't understand. Things you couldn't understand. Things you shouldn't understand.
Yeah, so obviously we'll start with Paul Reubens. In case you don't know, that's the actor who plays Pee-wee Herman, which I didn't know for the longest time. Like, until he got arrested, I think, was when I was like, oh, his name is not Pee-wee Herman.
Right.
Which was kind of by design. Like, he had specifically, he had decided this was going to be, he was going to keep this as his public persona. Just, he was doing multiple interviews because the character is really what made him famous. And he was doing interviews where he would have to be both people. And finally, he's decided, I'm just not going to be Paul anymore for interviews. For the public life, I'm only going to be Pee-wee. So, where did Pee-wee begin?
Well, he was born and kind of raised early in New York. So while he was still a kid, his family picked up and moved to Sarasota, Florida.
Yes.
Which that was actually the off-season home of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And so he got to go to like circus camp.
Yeah.
And started becoming like a performer. Almost took an interest in becoming maybe a circus performer.
Yeah.
Well, after he graduated from high school, he had an interest and wanted to discover the artistic side of himself. Mm-hmm. And so he moved out to California and enrolled in Cal Arts.
Yep.
And in his Cal Arts class was David Hasselhoff.
David Hasselhoff of Knight Rider fame and Baywatch.
Yep. And like Europe's greatest singer of all time.
Right. The Hoff. Yeah.
The Hoff. And then also Katie Sagal was in his class. She goes on to play Married with Children.
Yeah.
She plays Peg Bundy.
Yeah.
And so he starts to kind of grow and expand as a performer there at Cal Arts.
Yeah. He was wanting to be a serious actor. I mean, he did serious stuff at that time. And I think it was just, he was very popular at the school. In a school full of artists, he was still kind of the guy that everybody admired and sought after.
Yeah.
He stood out. So ultimately he, after college, he joins the Groundlings.
That's right. And the Groundlings are kind of a improv group. It was kind of a class.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a thing until people started to become attracted to him and wanted to get involved. And then they're like, well, we need to like come up with a name for ourselves and put on shows. And so
yeah,
from the Groundlings, like Edie McClure, the secretary from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yes.
Freaking hilarious.
Yep.
She works the counter in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yes.
And so she's in it. And of course, you have Paul Reubens.
Lorraine Newman.
Lorraine Newman, one of the earliest members of Saturday Night Live.
Yep. Cassandra.
Cassandra Peterson.
There you go.
Who played Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Yeah. So Cassandra Peterson talks about when she first came to the school, she was still just barely developing the Elvira character. And she saw two guys talking to each other. And it was Paul Reubens and John Paragon. And she said, I immediately said, I'm going to make friends with those guys. Like, they just had such a great chemistry. She could just tell that they were the guys that she wanted. And she was like, it's a little stalkerish, but I wanted to be with those guys because they knew they had such great ability to improv and riff off of each other. Now, if you don't know who John Paragon is, you might know him as Jombie the Genie in Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Mecca lecca hi, mecca hidey ho.
Now, everyone at home, mecca lecca hi, mecca hiney ho.
Mecca lecca hi, mecca hiney ho.
And as a connection to these two movies, he is Fletcher Jr. He's the, I'm sorry, did I do that?
You blew my mind when you sent that to me this week.
Yes, so John Paragon, who doesn't have a whole lot of other stuff to his name,
right,
is a major player in both of these scenarios, right? He's not in, I don't think he's in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Where is he?
He is one of the guys on the Warner Brothers lot.
Okay. So, but very small part. Like breeze by it part, but yes, a major player for not only Pee-wee's Playhouse later on, but his stage show, the Pee-wee Herman Show, which we'll get to here in just a second, right?
That's right. That's right.
So at the Groundlings, Paul Reuben realizes, he's like, you know what? I'm funny. Like, I'm good at being funny. I don't know why I'm so focused on all this serious work when I enjoy being funny. I get laughs. And so this may be my road to success. And so he develops this incredible character that is a lounge singing Native American.
You know, I saw him talk about this. He said it wasn't just racist. It was blatantly, incredibly racist. And he's like, I didn't really realize
it's a different
that.
Time,
you
right?
Know?
It's a different time. And it's the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, he's watching The Village People.
Oh my gosh. And he thought, this is my ticket out. Like, this is the character that I'm going to make famous with.
Yeah.
And he's like, thank God that didn't come true because it was so racist. But, you know, he created like dozens of characters.
Dozens. And anybody else who's in these comedy troupes who has these dozens of characters, he goes to audition for Saturday Night Live. And he thinks he's got it. Like, he's at the top of his game. He's got all these characters. He's raring to go.
And everybody else is telling him, you're shooing. You got it.
And he gets there, and he's watching this guy perform, and he's like, who is this guy? And they're like, oh, that's one of the producer's best friends. And he's like, oh, no. He's like, he's the nerdy guy. Like, there, you have a select group of people in Saturday Night Live. One of them's going to be the nerdy guy. It's going to be him. And that guy was Gilbert Gottfried.
Gilbert Gottfried. That's right.
And so he was right. He did not get cast in Saturday Night Live. And he thought his career was over. He thought it was done. And then inspiration strikes.
Yeah. So he goes back home. And one of the things that he learned from Saturday Night Live, he was so desperate to get in that he didn't want to be dependent on anybody else. And so he thought, you know what? I'm going to take control of myself and control what I can control. Mm-hmm. And so he had a character that he had been developing that seemed to be received well by audiences. And so he thought, I'm going with this character.
Right. And so this character is Pee-wee Herman.
Pee-wee Herman.
Morning, Mr. Breakfast. Can I have some Mr. T cereal? Okay. I pity the poor fool. Don't eat my cereal.
So he develops this entire, basically, skit show, a stage production called the Pee-wee Herman Show. And John Peregrine is a factor in that. Like, they're literally driving around. He's like, I want to be a genie. They're driving around and they see a sign. I can't think it was like a grocery store sign, but Jombie is, it's Jombie's place. And he says, they're both like, that's the name. That's got to be Jombie the Genie, right?
Jombie the Genie.
And then, of course, the other guy that's helping out is Phil Hartman.
So Phil Hartman was at first kind of too shy to join the Groundlings.
Yeah, he's a very straight-laced guy. He was in advertising, I think, and just...
He made, like, album covers.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was a graphic artist.
Designing graphic art for album covers. That's right.
But he was drawn to them, so he kind of hung around, but he didn't feel good enough to get involved until he did.
Until he did.
And then he and Paul Reubens hit it off and became really good friends.
Yeah, and he was a major writer, not only for the Pee-wee Herman Show. He performed in the Pee-wee Herman Show. But what happens with the Pee-wee Herman Show is that they start in the small theater, in the Groundlings Theater, less than 100 people, like 99 people, but they sell out. And then they keep selling out. And they're like, okay, we got to go to a bigger place. And they do the Roxy.
The Roxy.
And they sell out the Roxy. And one of the people that sees them perform at the Roxy is Steve Martin.
Steve freaking Martin.
And Steve Martin is like, here's my manager. You need to talk to him. And this guy had a protege. That guy became Pee-wee Herman's manager. He came in like he knew what he was doing. And he said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take this stage show and we are going to make it a nationwide tour. And what we want to do is develop enough of a following that by the time we're done, that you are such a well-known name and such a draw, such an influencer at the time before that term really existed, that the studios won't have any way to say no to developing a full movie for you.
That's right.
And that's exactly what they did. And they sell out Carnegie Hall. They sell out for 22 shows. They sell out the theaters and they make their way all the way back to LA. And at their final show, it is full of Hollywood producers. And he gets a standing ovation at the end of the show that goes on and on and on. And their plan worked perfectly because Warner Brothers said, we want to make your movie.
It's incredible. So I was telling you, in 1981, HBO, early HBO, when they had about five things to show, they broadcast the...
It was still called Home Box Office.
That's right. So I spent the night with some buddies, and we watched the Pee-wee Herman Show, which at that time was not directed at kids. It was adult humor framed in like a kid's show.
Right.
And we thought it was the freaking hilarious... It was the funniest thing we'd ever seen.
What is this mermaid missing? Earrings.
But you know, he hypnotizes a woman.
Uh-huh.
You are getting very sleepy. And he makes her take off her clothes on stage. And we thought, oh my God, this is the pinnacle of humor. Of course, that woman was a part of the Groundlings as well.
Yeah.
So that HBO show was huge.
Yep. Marty Kulner, right?
Marty Kulner directed that. That's right.
Yeah.
And he went on to do Hard Knocks and the Whitesnake videos.
Yeah,
he was
the HBO guy, yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
But in the early 80s, mm-hmm. he would go on the David Letterman show and like kind of the precursor to the Larry King show.
Yeah.
There was a show on CNN that came on late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go on and be interviewed not as Paul Rubens, but as Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
And he would also come on David Letterman. And he said he and Dave kind of hit it off. They had a chemistry.
Yeah, Dave was a good straight man for his goofy Pee Wee Herman guy.
And he was a regular. He came on like every two months or so.
Yeah.
And so he had kind of built this thing with Letterman
yeah.
and his show. And Warner Brothers is like, yes, we want to make a movie with you.
Right. So he and Phil Hartman and a guy named Michael Farhall get together and they start working on the script. And they've got Sid Field's screenplay. You know, the book.
I know, right?
This is the guidebook on how to write a screenplay. I read it whenever I was in college doing my screenwriting class. It's here's how you do it. This is the way you write. And
that's right.
They followed it letter for letter, note for note. But what they were trying to do initially when they were writing it was they were trying to, Paul Rubens' favorite movie was Pollyanna with Haley Mills in it. And he was trying to write Pee-wee as Pollyanna.
Right.
And they're on the Warner Brothers lot and he notices like everybody on the lot is getting around on bicycles. Like they, you know, there are a few people who've got the golf carts, but really no cars are driving around. Everybody's driving around on bicycles. And he keeps going like, what do I got to do to get a bicycle? Why can't I have a bicycle? Right. And so after weeks of this, he shows up and as a gift, there is just this gift waiting for him of this vintage Schwinn, like 1940s, 50s model bicycle, red and white, beautiful. And he says, in that moment, I realized this is what the script has to become.
We're writing the wrong movie.
We're writing the wrong movie. They go scrap everything that they've written so far and they make it his big adventure is his bike gets stolen and he has to go get it back.
Pee-wee loves his bike more than he loves life itself, and it gets stolen.
Yeah, and it's kind of loosely based on the Bicycle Thieves, which I think is 1940s, 46,
that's right.
48, yeah. Something like that. So then they've got it, and they've got their script, and you were telling me that you paused it. Like
I did,
they've got their cork board where they're putting the Post-it notes up, and you said that it was like, how did it go?
So I'm looking at this picture of Phil Hartman, Michael Farhall, and Paul Rubens in there at the writing place. And behind them are a bunch of Post-it notes. And so I freeze and I look and I zoom in. One Post-it note says, Ghost Trucker. One note says, Alamo.
Uh-huh.
One note says, Rodeo Cowboy. And it was just these ideas.
Yeah.
Well, those ideas are weaved through the entire movie, which makes it freaking hilarious.
It's a simple plot structure that allows them to weave together these vignettes. Very much like National Lampoon Vacation, where, you know, you've got a road trip and you can just, these things happen along the way. It's a very easy way to string these things together, which will come up when we talk about UHF as well, of course.
No doubt.
And so they've got their script and they're ready to find a director. And Paul Rubens makes a list of 150 directors. Like he's like thinking of every movie that I love. I'm going to, you know, if I was anything I liked about the movie at all, I'm putting that director's name down. And so he gives the studio his list of 150 directors and they come back with one that's not on the list. And he looks at this and he's like, what has this guy done? And he looks and he's like, this is the wrong guy. This is not the right guy. And so he comes to him. He's like, I'm not going to do it with this guy.
Okay. So I sent you a video clip this week.
Yeah.
He dug his heels in on this, but keep in mind, he's not a movie star yet.
Neither was Sylvester Stallone.
That's right. His inspiration was Sylvester Stallone and the way he handled the Rocky franchise. So if you'll remember Sylvester Stallone, which we've never covered Rocky or any of the Rocky movies, which we will.
Yeah. There's no question. We will.
So Sylvester Stallone had written the script for Rocky. Mm-hmm. And when he took it to the studio, they said, great, we want to make this movie. Maybe we could have Chuck Norris be the boxer or whatever. He's like, no. I'm going to be the actor. And they said, no, we got to get somebody else. And he said, well, then it's not for sale, basically.
Right.
And he decided, this is the criteria. I'm the star if you want to make my movie. And he went all in on himself.
Right.
And so Paul Rubens was like, well, Sylvester Stallone did it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that as well.
Right.
And he got some advice. They're like, listen, the winds of change happen fast around here.
Yeah. People in the studio are gone. You're going to not have your picture anymore.
And he said, I'm willing to tough it out.
Yeah. So the way that they put it to him was if you can find a director by whatever it was,
one week.
Yeah. 1 week. You got 1 week to find a director.
Yep.
They have to be approvable, affordable, and available.
The three A's.
Pretty tough call,
it
right?
Tough
I mean,
call.
If you're in Hollywood and you're a good director, you're probably working, right?
Yeah.
And so he goes, he's trying to find people. He's not having any luck. And he goes to a party that is being thrown by a friend of his who used to be a manager at a restaurant he worked at as a waiter or something, you know, just
right.
I mean, and he's just like, I can't find anybody. He's like, do you know any directors? And she's like, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, who? And she says, there's this young guy. I think he works over at Warner Brothers, actually. And he's made a couple little short things. I think he'd be great for you. His name is Tim Burton. Pee-wee's never seen this, never seen any of Tim Burton's work. But he looks and sees that Shelley Duvall is in this movie, this small movie that Tim has made called Frankenweenie.
Right.
And Shelley Duvall is a friend of his.
Yes.
And so he calls her. And he says, can you tell me, you know, here's my situation. And she's like, oh, Paul, he's perfect. He is perfect for you. So he watches Frankenweenie and he says, three scenes in, he knows this is the perfect director for his movie. And as it turns out, he's approvable, he's available, and he's affordable. And he wants to do the movie too.
Well, that's the thing. Once he said, yeah, Tim Burton, and a lot of people were like, oh, he turns down stuff all the time. He won't ever do it.
Turned down everything.
Yeah.
He had so many scripts coming to him and turning them all down. And when he saw this one, he said, this is the movie I want to make as my first real movie.
You think about it. They're both quirky characters.
Yeah.
They're both ultra creative.
Very, very
they're
weird.
They're kind of kindred spirits. That's right. They're weird. You know, you and I were talking before we started recording, kind of the third piece to the puzzle that may get overlooked, but is also an outsider, a weirdo, and ultra creative that contributed massively to the success of this movie and others is Danny Elfman.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we've talked before when we did our Batman episode about how Tim Burton and Danny Elfman came together. And I talked about the move there. Danny Elfman had composed the score to only one movie before, and it was years before. And it was this Oingo Boingo movie. Like, I think his brother might have directed it, maybe.
That's right.
Called The Forbidden Zone. And it's just so bizarre. Like, I looked at some of the pictures, just bizarre beyond bizarre. And of course, it was a favorite of Paul Reubens.
How about right? that? Yeah.
And so he was like, oh, this is great. Now, they had originally approached the guy from Devo.
That's right. The head guy of Devo.
Yeah. Was it Mark Mothersbaugh? Is that right?
I think that's
Mark
right.
Mark Mothersbaugh.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do it, but he ends up composing the theme to the Playhouse, to Pee-wee's Playhouse later on.
That's right. That's right.
So they bring in Danny Elfman, and yeah, it's this beautiful magic of
match made in heaven.
Great script, great director, great composer, and all on their virgin run, if you will, at a major motion picture.
You know, you mentioned it before. I want to kind of double down on what you said.
Yeah.
This script for Pee-wee's Big Adventure is studied at like script writing classes.
Really?
Because do you know? Because
they followed the format, right?
They followed the formula exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's a 90-minute movie. Mm-hmm. The script is 90 pages long.
Yeah.
Act one is over on page 30.
Yep, that's when the bicycle gets stolen.
and knitting. Yeah.
Jimmy, what is this? Too late. Chip.
Looks like a pen.
Exactly. I bought this pen 1 hour before my bike was stolen.
Why? What's the significance? I don't know.
Act two is over on page 60.
Yep.
And then the movie ends on page 90.
Resolution. Yep. Here's the rest of the story.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right? No, this is perfect. You're gonna love this, right? So the budget on this movie was $5 to $6 million.
Not much.
Not much. It's a low budget. Even, you know, in the '80s, that's a low budget movie, right?
Yes. Yes.
It grosses something like $50 million. So it's a phenomenal success for
huge.
Such a low
sleeper
like,
hit.
Unexpected. Like, yes, that's what they were like. They had no anticipation that anybody would like this movie, and it's this huge, huge success. So that propels Pee-wee to have his own TV show, which is a great thing. It propels Danny Elfman to do another movie called Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice, yeah.
And Tim Burton is directing that movie. I think I said Danny Elfman first. Those two guys together do Beetlejuice. And that, Tim Burton, showing that he can pull off two movies, not just one, but pull off two successful movies, then leads to, in 1988, him being tapped to do Batman.
Batman.
Now, Batman gets released on June 23rd, 1989, amongst a handful of other movies, including Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society. You got more for me?
I got the list.
Hit me, give me, give me.
So it is my belief that the summer of 1989 is the greatest summer for movies in the 80s.
Yes.
I'm going all time. Because, so listen to this. Starting in May, you've got Fright Night 2, Roadhouse, Dead Poets Society, Star Trek V. Now, keep in mind, some of these movies turned out good, some of them didn't, but every week you're like, oh man, Star Trek V is hitting the theaters. And after that, Ghostbusters 2 is coming out, right?
Yeah, Ghostbusters 2, yeah.
And then Batman and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and Do the Right Thing and Karate Kid 3 and Weekend at Bernie's and Lethal Weapon 2 and License to Kill and When Harry Met Sally and Turner and Hooch, Parenthood, The Abyss, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, Uncle Buck. Week after week after week, you have incredible movie in 1989.
Named actors, named directors, big time stuff going on. And then in July, just 4 weeks to the day after Batman is released, this little $5 million movie called UHF gets released.
And it gets buried by Riggs and Murtaugh and
and Batman.
And Batman.
And Batman. Tim Burton is burying UHF.
That's true.
So $5 million budget. It's opening weekend. It does four something. It ultimately grosses a little bit more. Like it gets to six.
Right.
But not a success.
Not a success.
Not a success at all. And it's only after people have kind of weeded through all of these huge monumental movies that have come out to really go, wait, this movie's actually good.
It's funny.
Like, this is a definitive cult classic. It did so poorly, it went out of print. And yet, even out of print, people obsess over this movie. So, Weird Al, I don't need to go to the whole history. And by the way, go check out our Weird episode so that you can get the full history. And I go into all kinds of detail about parodies and the inspiration for Weird Al to do his parody songs. But to make the story short, Weird Al, he gets an accordion. His mom buys him an accordion from a door-to-door salesman when he's a little kid.
And right.
She's like, well, this will make him popular. He learns how to play it. He goes on to become a DJ at his college where he gets his handle of Weird Al Yankovic. And then he's playing a lot of weird stuff that he's not really allowed to play and ultimately gets fired. But in the process of all of this, he meets a guy going, you know, college to college, who's got his own strange show called Dr. Demento.
That's right.
And so he meets Dr. Demento. He's like, hey, you know, love your stuff. They kind of form a little bit of a bond. And then a really popular song at the time, song that we've covered on our Patreon episode, is called My Sharona.
That's right. That's right. And he comes up with
My Bologna.
My Bologna.
And spoiler alert for the movie, this is true. He records it inside of a bathroom to get the reverb effect.
Right.
He sends his tape to Dr. Demento. Dr. Demento plays it and it becomes a huge success. He ultimately then goes on to follow this up with I Love Rocky Road.
Another One Rides the Bus.
A lot of fantastic parody songs. And his theme, you know, he won't make a parody of a song if the original artist says no. But he says it doesn't hurt to ask.
Right.
And Michael Jackson's Beat It is at the top of the charts. And Weird Al comes up with an idea for a parody. And there's no way Michael Jackson. Well, it doesn't hurt to ask. And Michael Jackson says yes.
Yes.
And that's when Weird Al moves from good to great.
When Eat It came out, I remember at the skating rink, people going bonkers when they played Weird Al Eat It.
Yeah.
And then as he grows as a comedian, his fun, you know, his songs are super clever. They're funny. Plus he can sing. I mean, plus, you know, the music's good and stuff like that.
The music is absolutely solid, yes.
But he goes up a notch with the music videos.
Right. And so he when he gets in this position of becoming famous for his parody songs, he needs video. MTV came out in 81. It's all happening at the same time. And so he needs videos for his stuff. And so who does he get to do it? He gets his manager to direct the videos, a guy named Jay Levy.
Jay Levy.
And so Jay Levy creates these perfect parodies of the I Love Rock and Roll video and the Michael Jackson Beat It video. I mean, if you watch it, it's so well done. Like, it's literally like I can't imagine how they didn't go to the exact location. And maybe they did. Maybe they went exactly where it had gotten filmed. But they produce it nearly frame for frame with comic elements throughout. And it's brilliantly done.
I think they did with the Fat video. I think they went to the exact same spot where they filmed Bad.
Sure, yes.
So, you know.
So Jay Levy is able to do with Fat what Martin Scorsese did with Bad. And that's genuinely impressive. That's like, incredible, right? I can't go out and recreate a Martin Scorsese video. That's impressive stuff, right? And so they...
For those of you who have forgotten that Martin Scorsese directed the Bad video... Go back to our very first episode. That's right.
All right. So we don't know how long Jason was frozen in frame. Like mid-sneeze. Sorry about that. We weren't watching the cameras. Anyway, so Jay Levy and Weird Al have gotten together. They've made great music. They've made great videos. They come out with Weird Al in 3D, which I had the tape. I wore it.
When are we covering Weird Al of 3D?
I know, right? And it's so successful. They're like, what else can we do? And the idea comes up, well, what if we do a movie? And we just, you know, we've got all these crazy ideas for these parodies. Let's figure out how to make this into a movie.
So here's one of the interesting stories about this. Do you know who Gene Kirkwood is?
Gene Kirkwood, is he a producer?
He is a producer.
Yeah, okay. Give me more.
So he produced the movie Rocky.
Oh, well, that's something.
Right?
Yeah. Speaking of Sylvester Stallone, right?
How about knock a home run? You know?
Right.
So Jay Levy and Weird Al have written the script. They're passing it around Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up in Gene Kirkwood's assistant's hands. They read it. They think it's really funny.
Yeah.
They give it to this is the producer of Rocky. Hey, yeah. You're the producer of Rocky. How about a Weird Al movie? Okay.
I don't know how that works, but
now,
sure.
I was going to tell you this. So he made Rocky. He also made The Pope of Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
He also made Get Rich or Die Trying. Remember the 50 Cent movie?
Okay.
He also made a movie that we have talked about many times, but have never seen, A Night in Heaven.
Isn't this the Bryan Adams?
This is the Bryan Adams
movie. Bryan Adams made the song Heaven for this movie.
Yes.
And nobody knows of this movie.
That's right.
It's starring the guy from the Blue Lagoon, right?
Then it's about male strippers, right? Right?
That's right. I don't know how we haven't seen that one.
So I know, right? So he produced all those movies.
Uh-huh.
He gets his hands on it, and he's like, yeah, let's do this, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, serious.
Well, he had been watching the videos, and he had already had an interest in, like, maybe we can make this guy into a movie star.
So, serious producer says, let's make this guy a movie star.
Yeah.
I've also got another name for you.
Okay.
Gray Fredrickson.
Yeah.
You know who this guy is?
Yeah, we've talked about him a few times before. I think maybe just me and you, but he was a guy who he was involved in The Godfather.
The Godfather.
The Godfather 2.
Apocalypse Now.
The Outsiders. Every Francis Ford Coppola movie that he did in the first 10 years of his career, Gray Fredrickson is a producer on those movies. Now, if you go back to our catalog, we have covered The Outsiders versus Rumblefish, both of them Francis Ford Coppola movies, both of them produced by Gray Fredrickson, and they were both filmed in Tulsa.
That's right. So before we move on to Tulsa, if I say that UHF was produced by the same people who produced Rocky, The Godfather, and Apocalypse Now, I'm telling the truth.
Yeah, that's true.
Mind blown.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the things that they said to Weird Al and Jay Levy, say, hey, we want to make this movie with you, but you got to make it for $5 million or less. Can you pull that off? So all of a sudden they're like, well, we got to do this on the cheap.
Yeah.
So where can we film this movie on the cheap? LA's not cheap. You know what is cheap?
Oklahoma.
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And so Gray Fredrickson, who based out of Oklahoma City.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think he went to OU.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
So he says, hey, guys, you know, we did The Outsiders and Rumblefish in Tulsa. People were great.
Everybody's excited. Yeah. Yeah.
People are happy to have you there. You have everything you need to shoot a movie there.
Yeah.
What do you think? So that they're like, yep, let's go. Cheap production, UHF in Tulsa.
There you go. By the way, go check out that location's filming locations video that Jason and I shot a few weeks ago. Super fun. And dun, da, 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 Spatula City, Spatula City, Spatula City.
See this?
We bought it at Spatula City. For real.
That's true. It was the last one.
The golden spatula, if you will.
It was the last one.
Nothing says, I love you.
You know, we did buy that at the same grocery store that they shot Spatula City at.
Yeah.
That place is down kind of a rougher part of town.
Uh-huh.
They had a cop making sure nobody was shoplifting.
Uh-huh.
And we could have pulled down his pants and pushed him over and stolen everything in the store.
I'm sorry if you're watching, sir, but literally I was like, I don't know that he would be any help at all if anybody did anything in that store.
We could have tied his shoelaces together and stolen anything we wanted.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
Let's move on to casting.
Let's flip back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Sounds good.
I say we hang him, then we kill him.
Yeah!
I say we stomp him.
Yeah!
Then we tattoo him.
Yeah!
Then we hang him.
Yeah!
And then we kill him.
Yeah!
I say we let him go.
No!
All right, so we have Paul Reubens as Pee-wee Herman.
You don't want to get mixed up with a guy like me. I'm a loner, Daddy. A rebel.
Talked about him.
Yes.
Let's talk about the little pint-sized smoke show known as E.G. or Elizabeth Daly.
Elizabeth Daly.
She plays Dottie.
Come on, Dottie. Let's go.
Let's go. Don't you want to see the rest of the movie?
I don't have to see it, Dottie. I lived it.
Now, we've talked about her before. Because she was the singer. What was the movie? She was the singer in the band doing the show. Was it The Last Dragon?
It was Better Off Dead.
Better Off Dead. That was it.
Yeah. So she had been in the movie Valley Girl. Mm-hmm. And, of course, she's also in the movie Better Off Dead.
Right.
She also goes on to do, like, some incredible voice work.
She takes over the job as Tommy on Rugrats.
Tommy Pickles.
Yeah. Kavanaugh was the name of the actress who had done it originally, and she was also Dexter on Dexter's Laboratory. I don't know how I came across her just a few weeks ago, but it was this very sad thing where she died very young. I think she died at 55 or something. But she had voiced all of these incredible characters, but she said when she decided she was going to take a break and focus on her family, and she said, Elizabeth Daly is the perfect person to voice Tommy Pickles.
And she is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, then we also have Mark Holton as Francis.
Knock it off.
Cut it out.
Don't shut up, Pee-wee.
Why don't you make me?
Why don't you make me?
Because I don't make monkeys. I just train them.
I saw him and I immediately went to the stubbled fat basketball player on Teen Wolf.
Teen Wolf.
Like he looks like he's 37 years old out there the court smoking a cigarette.
That's right. Now we're going to cover Teen Wolf here in just a few weeks.
Yeah, we're going to do Teen Wolf versus Monster Squad.
The Monster Squad.
Which has another connection coming up here in the casting, right?
We'll talk about that here in just a second.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this was Pee-wee's Big Adventure was his first movie.
Mm.
They got him right out of acting school.
Okay.
Hired him right away. But do you know who they had in mind for the Francis part?
Nope. Yeah.
Corey Feldman was who they asked.
Oh,
he auditioned.
Really?
He got the part.
Uh-huh.
And then passed on it to do The Goonies.
Well, that was a good choice.
That was
a
good choice, yeah.
I could totally see him as the... I mean, the difference in those two people is amazing, it's though, right? Like
completely different.
Corey Feldman would have been a much more believable, bratty kid who wanted the bicycle. That would have been a great cast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Keep going.
All right. Then you have Diane Salinger. She plays Simone.
Do you have any dreams?
Yeah. I'm all alone. I'm rolling a big donut and the snake wearing a vest.
Simone, the waitress.
Let's talk about your big bet, Simone.
And her dreams.
Yeah.
What are your dreams, Pee? Well, I always have this dream.
He's a snake wearing a vest. And not that kind of dream. That part, correct? I watched that movie with Ava just the other day.
Uh-huh.
And he's talking about how, she's saying, it's my dream to go to Paris. And he's like, well, you should go. And she's like, yeah, but. And he's like, everybody I talk to has a butt. Let's talk about your big butt, Simone. And Ava thought that was so funny.
That's awesome.
All right. Then you have Judd Omen, who plays Mickey, the felon that Pee-wee picks up on the side of the road.
Great straight man.
When he pulls over and picks up Pee-wee, he's wearing broken handcuffs. It's clear that he's a felon. You're right. He is a great straight man. And Paul Reubens just goes crazy while in drag playing his wife.
Over the top. It's brilliant. He's a brilliant straight man for that part, and he's a brilliant straight man in his delivery of the line of the crime he committed. You know those tags on the back of the mattress? Do not remove. I just get really angry sometimes. It's brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, super funny. Okay. You just have kind of a cast of characters that kind of come in and out of his life throughout the movie. No real major players, although I do want to point out you have Cassandra Peterson.
Yes.
Otherwise known as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Yep.
Who plays the biker chick.
Give him to me.
I say you give him to me first.
Yeah.
I say you let him go. That's Cassandra Peterson.
Yeah.
You also have John Paragon, who plays one of the actors on the lot. We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to point out you have Jason Hervey.
Jason Hervey is the actor who is gifted the bicycle for the movie that is being shot. Now, Jason, this was 1985, shooting in 84, right?
Yeah.
And another movie that came out in 85 that you might have heard of, it's called Back to the Future, where he plays a young coonskin capped uncle to Marty McFly.
That's right.
What's a rerun?
it's brand new.
Then just 2-3 years later, we get the Wonder Years, where he is Kevin's older brother.
Yep.
Yeah.
He also has a part in the Monster Squad, which we're going to talk about here in just a few weeks.
Ah, perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
One of the people that I wanted to point out to you as well in that shot with Kevin, who's arguing with the director, she's like, this kid is driving me crazy and I can't take him anymore. That's Lynn Stewart.
Okay.
She is in The Groundlings.
Oh, okay.
And she plays Miss Yvonne.
Oh, Miss Yvonne. Yes. Oh, okay. Oh, yes. Fantastic. I love it.
A lot of his friends making appearances.
By the way, spoiler alert for the Pee Wee show. He gets one wish from the genie. He wants to fly.
I'm the luckiest boy in the whole world.
But Miss Yvonne wants...
Captain Carl.
Captain Carl to like her.
To like her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Pee-wee decides to give his wish to Miss Yvonne. He wishes for that to come true. And because he chose to do the right thing, he gets his wish too, which is to fly. The luckiest boy in the world.
Very biblical right there. A couple other people I want to point out to you that I think are just freaking off the chain funny in this.
Yeah.
You have James Brolin.
Brilliant.
Who plays P.W.
P.W. Herman.
P.W. Herman.
Have you got any messages for room 104? The name's Herman. P.W. Herman.
No, nothing right now, Mr. Herman.
And he's the guy in charge of the X-1.
Right? Yes. And then, of course, the movie Dottie, Morgan Fairchild.
Morgan Fairchild in her hottest of hottest.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm married to Morgan Fairchild. Yeah.
You also have Milton Berle make a cameo.
He does. He's walking through.
That's how Pee Wee gets on the lot.
Yeah, in his entourage.
He's telling a joke, and Pee Wee's like, ha, 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 that's so funny. Ha. And he sneaks onto the lot.
Uh-huh.
Remember the last time we talked about Milton Berle?
I do, because he is Uncle Milty, and he's the real uncle to Marshall Berle, who discovered Van Halen, and then after losing Van Halen, got a little band called Rat.
Called Rat. That's right. Speaking of Rat, you have a cameo of Twisted Sister.
I had no idea that was coming. My mind was blown. I was like, what?
Oh
fantastic.
So Twisted Sister is shooting a music video on the lot, and here comes Pee-wee riding his bike right through the middle of it.
That's brilliant. Okay, so that does it for casting for Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Come back, join us next week. We will do part two. We will dive in on casting on UHF. We will talk about soundtracks. We will talk about funny bits. We'll talk about tidbits. All kinds of fun stuff. Be sure and join us for that. And then, of course, we'll give you our final judgment on which of these two movies, these two weird movies, are the best. We will see you guys then. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, kid. What's your name?
I can't remember.
Where are you from?
I can't remember.
Can't you remember anything?
I remember the Alamo.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.